Hi, welcome to the China Unscripted podcast. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
I just want to remind everyone, be sure to check us out on iTunes as well as ChinaUnscripted.com. Joining us today, we have a special guest, Matthew Robertson. Matt, why don't you say hello and give us a little introduction.
Hello. I'm a researcher, I guess. I was a translator and am a translator. I work at the a nonprofit in D.C. called the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. Currently, I'm a research fellow in China Studies.
Oh, you know, I hear there's a lot of victims of communism, so yes. that's good business.
And I'm about to start a PhD at the Australian National University in January.
Oh, congratulations. You know, I hear Australian universities are very popular with Chinese students.
Yes, there's actually heaps at ANU. And either because there are so many or they're just way more studious than the drunken Australians. When you go to the library, it's only Chinese.
Wow. I also appreciate the use of the word the heaps. It's going to be a folks little podcast.
Well, I mean, yeah. Well, it's thematically appropriate for Australia.
How so?
Isn't that Australian slang?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you were at ANU, Chris.
I was. That was a. If you haven't seen the episode, we have a. It was so. Thinking back on it, it was insane. We were interviewing Alice Joski about Chinese interference in Australian universities, and I spent most of the episode walking around in a toga.
Outside of your suit, yes.
That's
this
right.
This is a family-friendly podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alex was. I think he was pleased. So anyways, enough about me and what I do at other people's colleges. So Matt, you've recently done some writing comparing the persecution of Uyghurs in Xinjiang to the persecution of another group inside of China, Falun Gong.
Which we then shamelessly used for
Don't give our secrets away.
Okay.
Shelley. So let's begin talking about the Uyghurs. Why is the Communist Party targeting the Uyghurs, do you think?
I don't know.
All right. Thanks for joining us. And I'm Chris Chappell.
Let's start with...
Well, it's mysterious, right?
It is.
All these campaigns.
Well, yeah, that's China is kind of a black box, so there is no clear way to know what's happening. So I've heard, like on the one hand, I've heard it's... persecution is about ensuring the Belt and Road, ensuring, like, the party wants to maintain stability there in a Communist Party kind of way to make sure it's a road, the Belt and Road can connect through it. I've also heard it's an analysis that it's actually Xi Jinping's opponents trying to create trouble in Xinjiang to specifically mess up the Belt and Road. So that's one of those things where you hear completely different views on a single thing. And that's what makes being a China watcher so difficult.
If I had to make up something, I would
please do.
Imagine that it's like, just this is the CCP's MO, and that's the simplest way to understand it. Like, every 10 years or so, because the way they, like, it's a mobilizational kind of party. Mm. Like, it stirs up political campaigns and then uses them to, you know, direct a lot of resources to some specific goal. And the people on that gravy train get promoted. And especially when issues are elevated to the level of a threat against the party and the nation, then, you know, it's like the threat is created.
Well, you bring up a good point there by saying it's the Communist Party's MO. I know a lot of people have been kind of reacting to this persecution against the Uyghurs with shock. Like, oh my gosh, look at what the Communist Party is doing. This is so surprising. And yet, as you mentioned, this is the MO of the Communist Party.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And also, that ties back into the persecution of Falun Gong, which you've described the persecution of Falun Gong as being very similar to the persecution that's happening with the Uyghurs. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. I think these are very interesting campaigns because they are... both of them, they're so radical in their intent. Like, it's literally about, like, capturing, as you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people. and then, you know, forcefully, like, brainwashing them through torture and, like, ramming your information down their throat and then making them agree that their beliefs are false. It's so extreme and radical, and it's the same. I mean, that was the anti-Falun Gong campaign, basically. That was its operating logic, and that were those were the quotas that were passed down all throughout the system. It's like transform them, Zhuanghua. And so the same, you know, it's exactly, well, perhaps there are some differences, but it's very much the same thing in Xinjiang.
What does transform mean?
It means that in disguise.
It means that they must. So that's funny. This is what makes it beyond the regular podcast.
Oh, it's just my own ignorance.
The side jokes.
All right, Transformer jokes aside, let's go to this horrible, bloody persecution. Perfect segue.
It's when they make the target renounce their faith and agree with the Communist Party's slogans about it, basically. So whether that's actually genuine or it's just something that's done to get out of there alive, the effect is the same. And, I mean, so that's what it is on the surface. So they, you know, and they also, I mean, it can, like with the anti-Falun Gong campaign, there were specific, things that they had to sign. So, like, they had to make three agreements, like, to not practice Falun Gong again, to not promote Falun Gong again, and something else. I'm not sure what it was, and it was implemented in different ways. But it's basically to get people to agree that their beliefs are false and that the party is right. And then when they sign the stuff, then, you know, that's, you know, like, tick the box. This person has been reformed, and then they're released back into the society to
be happy, productive members of communist society.
To be restless screws, yes. Yeah.
Well, that actually sounds kind of similar to what's happening with Christians in China now, where they're being forced to take down crucifixes or pictures of Jesus and put up pictures of Xi Jinping, or sign guarantees that they're not going to practice Christianity, or that they're going to put party ideology above their religious beliefs.
Well, I need to. This is something I haven't studied specifically, but okay. I think at the very least that there's one distinction between these campaigns, which is that with Falun Gong and the Uyghurs, clearly the CCP wants to eliminate those populations. But with Christianity, they seem simply satisfied with limiting them. And that's just that calls for an entirely different set of methods, a different theory, different agencies involved. So I would consider them to be different beasts in a sense.
Why do you say it's clear that they want to eliminate Uyghurs and Falun Gong?
Because that's what everything they do to those populations suggests. And I mean, this was kind of explicit, at least in the when promulgating the policy of the anti-Falun Gong campaign, that they set up a leading small group for handling the Falun Gong question at the Politburo Standing Committee level. So this is a very peak of the policy process in China. Like, there were only seven, I believe at the time, seven members of the PBSC. And so this is like a very peak body in Chinese politics, specifically created to eliminate or to deal with this population. So the Uyghur, you know, what they're doing in Xinjiang doesn't have the same, like, total central imprimatur, but it's, you know, being led in the same manner at the provincial level. And at least in the Uyghur case, I haven't seen the... have they come out? I don't believe they have, and said, you know... I mean, they've said that it's about de-extremification and getting rid of terrorists, but they haven't said that, actually, we don't like Uyghurs existing. We're just going to, like, turn them into Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't said that. But, you know, everything they're doing suggests that that's the goal. With the Falun Gong case, it was clear that it's not a population that should exist. Like, you know, it's bad, it's dangerous, they kill themselves.
The language is very much wipe them all out.
Yeah. Well, at least that's what was said in a meeting, according to someone who's now outside of China in Beijing in 99. Eliminate them. It's bankrupt them financially, eliminate them physically, destroy them spiritually, or whatever. I forget the exact phrase, but yes, that was clearly the policy, to destroy them.
What occurs to me, a lot of people listening might not really be too familiar with Falun Gong now. This was a bigger issue a couple years ago, but now you tend not to hear as much about Falun Gong. So first, Matt, why don't you, for somebody who knows nothing about Falun Gong, can you say what it is?
Sure. Although I think it's helpful to go back to how big of a deal it was at the time.
Sure.
And to some degree still is. But even how it was, it was acknowledged as such at the time. Elizabeth Perry wrote this really interesting article in, I believe it's 2002, called Challenging the Mandate of Heaven. And she laid out how it was that the anti-Falun Gong campaign was like the most significant political campaign against a single target in PRC history.
Well, in the history, really?
Yeah, well, because, so if you look at CCP political campaigns, I mean, like, you can understand the whole history of the CCP even before it took power as one big political mobilization campaign that, achieved certain objectives, and a lot of resources were aggregated to pursue it. And then, you know, people chill out for a while, and then another one starts up. And so that's clear from the Yan'an rectification. And then in the early years of the PRC, when the CCP is eliminating different perceived to be problematic populations, the Cultural Revolution, anti-bourgeois spiritual pollution campaign after Tiananmen, a whole other round of arrests, anti-Falun Gong campaign. Even the anti-corruption campaign of Xi Jinping follows the same kind of logic. And then the Uyghurs. So, you know, to me, this is just a very intuitive, straightforward way to understand, you know, major ways that the CCP, like, works. Because a lot of people's careers, like, in the party are determined, you know, by the participation in these campaigns. Certainly with the anti-Falun Gong campaign, you know, careers were made and destroyed, in fact. And by the early 2000s, it was like a key priority issue for the leadership under Jiang. And so the people who implemented it more forcefully were brought up through the ranks more quickly, and, you know, enormous resources were devoted to it. But what was kind of remarkable about it in comparison to all other CCP campaigns was because it was focused on, like, one population, like eliminating one population. Other campaigns have kind of somewhat broader goals, like the Cultural Revolution, for example. And so that makes it pretty unique. And so I forgot what the question was. Oh, it was, what's Falun Gong? Okay.
Yeah. So, and why it's a big deal,
I guess,
deal,
I was saying.
Say.
Yeah, so I guess I was starting first with why it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a big deal. That's only after the fact. Although before the fact, it was still quite a unique thing and kind of a big deal in China. And it's, what is Falun Gong? It's a Qigong practice.
Like Tai Chi, kind of.
Kind of, but the best treatments of this, it grew out of the Qigong movement in China, and there were thought to be several hundred million people practicing that, at least 100 million people.
And Qigong or Falun Gong in particular?
So Qigong was one of the... So Falun Gong was one of the gongs of many kinds of Qigong that emerged in the 80s and 90s. And Qigongs are like, you know, it's kind of like a meditation, slow movement practice. It's believed that they can use, harness energy of the body and the universe to do things.
Like Dragon Ball.
Yeah, Gotcha. A spiritual technology is the is a great way of heard it described. And so, you know, these have a history and a theory in Chinese religion and philosophy. And you can get books. There's this amazing book. It's called Shenxian Zhuan in Chinese. I forget the exact, but there was a guy, Robert Ford Campany, did this amazing translation. It's like all these immortals in Chinese history, and they like go to some Taoist, they go to some cave, and then they cultivate these powers, and then they get into fights. And it's so cool.
Fun.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's like 700 pages, and it's like just one immortal after another. And so this is like a thing.
I feel like we've found the like origin of like Dragon Ball Z.
Basically. Well, Journey to the West.
Well, that's true. That was actually the origin. But maybe,
which was immortals fighting each
okay,
other.
Okay, so maybe Shenxian Zhuan is like the origin of like superhero comics.
Okay.
There's something to this, because the idea is that these people, by you know, practicing this spiritual technology and using moral discipline, they're able to change themselves and get powers because they're like assimilating to the universe, and the universe inherently has these, you know, magical properties. And so, you know, Falun Gong went kind of beyond Qigong in not just because a lot of the Qigongs, they were like, you know, you can practice and you get this and that supernormal power, and there are people doing all kinds of supernatural things, supposedly. And what's very...
Sort of like how if we sign up for some exercise program, it guarantees we can lose a pound of belly fat a week.
Yeah, except
that's
it was like...
That's definitely supernatural.
You can put a needle through glass and stuff. So this was a huge thing in China.
Okay.
The crazy thing, like, so people thought this was real. And as far as, like, a large portion of the Chinese population concerned, this was real. And so Falun Gong came in that kind of environment. And it went beyond that in linking it to a moral practice. The others were like, you get these cool powers and you can be healthy and you can heal people.
But, like energy healing.
Yeah,
thing,
yeah. But Falun Gong was like, that stuff is true, but that's not the idea here. Like, the idea is to transform yourself morally and attain salvation in some cosmic sense through moral practice.
So it was a spiritual practice in what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah. Sounds like a dangerous group that should be crushed.
So, on the surface, what it is five exercises.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is a meditation. And in the beliefs, it has a truthfulness, compassion, and forbearance.
Yeah, that's definitely dangerous stuff.
Yeah, you can see why this couldn't remain.
No. So as I understand, Falun Gong became very popular. So according to, I believe, the government statistics, it's Falun Gong at its peak was anywhere from 70 to 100 million people practicing, which was a lot. Do you have any sense why Falun Gong in particular became so much more popular than some of the other Qigong practices that were out there?
Well, I mean, as a researcher, you can only know what Falun Gong people say and what other researchers who have studied it say. And it seems to be because, I mean, at least initially, people felt that their health was benefited,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then, you know, Falun Gong practitioners say, well, because it's true. So it's like, you know, that's why it was popular, because it's true.
Truth is true?
Well, people practiced it. There's like, you can read like sociological explanations, like, you know, after the reform era, faith in communism had been lost and people were looking for sort of spiritual.
So it was popular.
Spiritual spiritual
yeah, so, you know, how you explain big, broad social movements, it's it's an open question. But
okay, so let's just accept
case,
it got
people,
popular.
Yeah, people, a lot of people practiced it. It was, I mean, interestingly, it was spread by word of mouth. So someone practices it, then they tell their family. And it was, interestingly, well, until 1994, I believe, it had some institutional affiliation. It was under the Qigong Research Society. It's like there is a whole history here that, I mean, we can't go into the whole thing, but it's kind of useful, at least for understanding that Qigong had high-level patrons in the Communist Party.
Mm.
And they thought it was... a new kind of science, and it was a special Chinese kind of science, and that it would be able to rival Western science, and that it was new, that what was new was using the human body itself as an instrument for exploring truth and acquiring knowledge and, you know, acting in the world in ways that were beyond Western materialist empirical science. It's like, and this was a thing, like people actually believe this. The guy, very famous rocket scientist Chen Xuesen, who was behind the CCP's nuclear program, he was actually ironically chased out of the US by McCarthyites, and he wasn't a communist necessarily, I don't think, but I mean there's some controversy on that. In any case, so people like him, so like highly revered figure
And educated.
Yeah. And so these guys, like there was a whole group of these guys who basically figured out how they could explain Qigong in using like Marxist theoretical terminology.
Really?
So I they had like no passed idea. It off. Yeah. And so that's how it, like, they got through like the hardliners. So at least for a while.
So there's a Qigong Science Research Society that's affiliated with the Communist Party.
Yeah, it was under, I would have to check what it was actually under, but it was one of these mass organizations, or it was affiliated with one of the mass organizations. So there was, you know, so there's like a whole history there. So Falun Gong was originally under that. And then basically they wouldn't play ball with the official group, which wanted them to charge money and, like, you know, kick up the profits. And Falun Gong was kind of, you know, run in a very, like, lean. There was no organization, basically. It was a bunch of volunteers. And they wanted to, like, make money off it. And then...
So the organization... So Falun Gong, not wanting to make a profit, got in trouble with the communist state organs that wanted to make money.
That's one way you could put it, I suppose. But in the end...
Ironic.
In the end, Falun Gong was... It was deinstitutionalized in the sense that there was no... it was a bunch of volunteers in different cities that would act as contact people. And that's pretty much how it works outside of China now.
So did it get kicked out of the Qigong Science Research Society?
I believe the organization was, I mean, to that effect, yes. Mm-hmm. Or no, it withdrew, I believe, in the end. Well, so, the guy, the founder, Li Hongzhi, withdrew it. Mm-hmm. And then it had no institutional aegis. It applied to try to get one, because in China, if you just like have like thousands of people going to parks to practice something every morning, then, like, you know, the authorities are starting to ask, like, okay, so, like, what's up? Who are you? Who's your boss? Take me to your leader, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. It's a large group, not directly under the party supervision.
Right. And so, you know, and there's, like, disagreements or different ideas in terms of determining, like, what was it that made the CCP, like, lash out so violently and so extremely and in such a systematic way against Falun Gong. And there's like the, because they were organized, they were a big organization. And then there's like, because they were seen as an ideological challenge, et cetera. So there's different, yeah, it's different views. I'm the early, like after the campaign started in July 99.
The persecution campaign.
Yes, the anti-Falun Gong campaign. I think it is, you know, it's really instructive to look at what Xinhua was saying at the time and what the People's Daily was saying at the time.
The mouthpiece for the Communist Party, Xinhua.
Yes, yes. And their explanation was not that it's an organized group and it's going to overthrow the state or whatever. It was that it was a theistic practice that didn't conform to the goals of socialism with Chinese characteristics. That, you know, they were preaching idealism, and it was basically it was an ideological threat. And so, Jiang Zemin said the same thing, that our political thought work among grassroots cadres has been inadequate. That's the only reason they could go in for something like this. Uh-huh. And that Marxism will definitely triumph over the Falun Gong stuff. He wrote that in a letter, or words to that effect, in to other members of the Politburo Standing Committee in April 99. After that, there was a massive protest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or an appeal or whatever.
So is it actually Marxism or socialism with Chinese characteristics that they care about? Like, is it the ideology that they care about? Or is it that this was, like, a challenge to their political power or whatever?
Yeah, I think the latter. But the challenge is seen through an ideological lens.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a little hard to disentangle the two, because in the one sense, the ideology, whether it's like just a window dressing or something that's somehow deeply held, which there are many indications that it's not, which we can talk about, but at the very least, if there is some other ideology or belief that is extremely popular, then it appeared that the Communist Party felt threatened simply, you know, by dint of the popularity, because it's like, well, you know, those people, you know, they're not mm-hmm. they're not with the party. And mm-hmm. so if they're with this, so it's like, and they, you know, the Xinhua as well, they said it very explicitly, that Falun Gong was competing for the masses. So, you know, you can't compete for the hearts and minds of the masses with the Chinese Communist Party.
It's like the worst popularity contest ever.
Yeah, I'm thinking, like, most clubs try to be exclusive, like, you know, keep out people they don't like. The Communist Party is like, you have to be part of our group, otherwise we'll kill you.
Or, I mean, they only let the special people in, but, like,
you have everyone to... Everyone else has to admire themselves. Yes. I see.
But was it very interesting, because they... I would... They won't kill you if you don't want to be part of the group. They'll just make you be part of the group. And so if Falun Gong people, like, if they just said, oh, okay, well, I didn't know you guys didn't like that. Well, no problem. Like, we'll just stop practicing and we'll be good party members. What would you like us to do? What do we sign? Well, then, like, there would be no persecution of Falun Gong, right?
Well, it's interesting you say that.
Like, all right, I understand now.
Well, that's because this is the thing that, like, I think people have a hard time understanding if you grew up in America or, like, you just don't have a lot of familiarity with the ideological struggle part of the Communist Party, is that, like, it seems like, yeah, why do you care so much about whether people believe in truth, compassion, and tolerance, or whether they believe in Islam, or, like, it's, what's it to you, you know?
Yeah, well, there's the question of whether the degree to which this is just kind of naked power grubbing, and whether it's considered to be a genuine threat, because I think you could understand it from both perspectives in a way, because, like, say for the anti-Falun Gong campaign, and same with the campaign in Xinjiang, if you like cook up a threat and then you sell that to the higher ups and you're like a hardliner, I mean, you win, and there's no like downside, because then you've created a threat to the Communist Party, basically, and then because you've identified some group and then you've packaged it that way, and then now you get like carte blanche to deal with it, and then that's resources, that's promotions, that's power in the system. And so there's, you know, just from a practical perspective, there are many factors that, like amplify that, like that kind of tendency, and there are no mitigating factors against it really. So you can push hard in that direction. Like, this is just a common thing with communist systems. So, you know, there is a tendency for this to kind of snowball, and then for the, these are the logical outcomes of the structure, the political structure, and the way incentives operate.
Because that's how ultimately everyone gets their power and prestige, by,
or at least that is that's a surefire way, and there is nothing.
It's much easier than trying to, like, you know, raise GDP in your province.
Just build more skyscrapers. Mm-hmm. It's easy.
Build skyscrapers, or imprison a million people.
Both are good. Well, so since we're on this topic, so basically Falun Gong was very popular, and then it was persecuted by the Chinese Communist Party. And, or did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, well, so there were 3 years of jousting inside the party about mm-hmm. how they're going to deal with it. So it wasn't that everyone wanted to persecute it. There were some that were like, well, we need to guide them gently. Mm-hmm. And I was like, we don't need to worry about them. And this went on for at least 2-3 years, mm-hmm. like from 96 onwards, basically. And so there were a lot of, that was the other thing, there were a lot of people in the Communist Party who practiced Falun Gong, and in the military and so on. So, and Jiang Zemin got a letter from, I believe it was a former director of the 301 PLA hospital. So, like, a very top, he was a retired, very top doctor, like, in the party, wrote to Jiang saying, hey, like, please don't, you know, Falun Gong's good, and this long letter. And that, like, cheesed him off even more, because it's like, the CCP thinks, like, they're being infiltrated.
Mm. So wow. It's like, yeah.
Hmm.
Because this is, like, how the CCP got power, right?
Yes.
It's like infiltrates Kuomintang. And this is like a communist subversion, like 101. It's like you replace their people with your people, and then you become that thing.
It's a hard system to trust people in.
Well, that's the whole point. And in a sense, we're kind of getting off topic, but it relates to this whole issue, which is kind of that I've met a lot of democracy people that they don't like Falun Gong because it's not anti-communist party enough.
You mean Chinese democracy activists?
Yes, okay. Yes. And that seems an odd thing for them to think, because like Falun Gong, you know, like collects renunciations of the Communist Party and has very anti-Communist Party, you know, statements and rhetoric.
Although that was post.
Yeah, post, but
yeah, post yes. The anti-Falun Gong campaign. Yeah.
Yes. But even now, if you speak to Falun Gong practitioners, they won't say directly negative things about Xi Jinping, because he hasn't been, like, the anti-Falun Gong campaign under Xi has not been a political priority. Has not, like, it's still going on. There's still people being tortured and so on, and it's still very much on the books. But it's not like for the previous, 16 years, 13, 14 years, like, from, like, late 2013, 14, it's like, there hasn't been more political emphasis from the top against Falun Gong, you know, from the PBSC level. And so what was I saying? I was saying that the anti-democracy people, yeah, they have a problem. Yeah, and so it goes back to the kind of the subversion.
People,
yeah, the pro-democracy people. Yes, did I say anti?
You did.
Whoops. but it's simply that there is there is an understandable case for the concern that the Communist Party would be subverted by Falun Gong, in the sense that if eventually, like, all the Communist Party members, or like a large amount of them, were like, let's just say it's not Falun Gong, they're like Taoists and they actually believe in Taoism really seriously, and then they practice Taoism. Well, then, if you like told, like, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of Taoists to go massacre students, and they actually believe in the Taoism, and they like refused to do so, then you kind of have difficulty running a totalitarian regime.
It stops becoming the Communist Party and becomes normal human beings.
Yeah, and so I think there's something too, even though it seems very like bizarre, like, hey, it's just like the guy, you know, he's the former, you know, director of your hospital, and now he's got like this meditation practice he does. What's the big deal? But like, you kind of have to understand things from the CCP's point of view, if I may put it that way, in the sense that there is something to this, even though if you're thinking about things normally, well, you kind of couldn't countenance seeing someone's beliefs as a threat. But if you understand the totalizing mindset of the CCP, then you can quite readily understand how sincerely held religious and moral beliefs that determine your outlook and your conduct and how you respond to things, that is a very serious concern for the CCP.
A Chinese citizen needs to be ready to do anything the party wants at any time, and anything that gets in the way of following party directives is a threat.
I think that is true. I mean, you won't see that written down, perhaps not at least in the public documents that they promulgate, but I certainly think you could understand, you know, to a certain degree that the party operates in that manner.
So one thing you wrote in your article is the idea that many of the tactics the party used in persecuting Falun Gong, they kind of refined and perfected against Falun Gong, and now those tactics are being used against Uyghurs.
I read that, did I?
Something like that.
Okay.
I made it sound
That's
way
not,
better.
Not a bad point.
Yeah.
Well, I think...
Yeah, well, it was a good point.
At the very least, it's been a process of refinement.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe, hopefully, that was the point that I was trying to make. Because before the party took power, Michael Dutton has this really interesting book, Policing Chinese Politics, and he, at least to some degree, traces the refinement of, like, party purge campaigns And so, like, in the 20s in these Soviet areas, they were pretty brutal. Like, they just rounded up the Bolsheviks or, like, the anti... whoever was against the party leadership at the time, just shot them. It's like executions. Brutal. And then by Yan'an, they're, like, reforming them, brainwashing them. And that was for new, you know, intellectuals who had come to join the party and were suspected maybe being spies for the Kuomintang or many others. And, well, so the point is simply to say that there's been a constant process of refinement. And so whatever they've learned from the anti-Falun Gong campaign and all the... so whatever they learned from all those other decades of campaigns were applied to, you know, in the anti-Falun Gong campaign. And then I would certainly think that the same, you know, you can see all the very similar things with Uyghurs.
Mm-hmm. So they're upgrading their persecution technology.
It, broadly construed, I should think. But we haven't seen, like... so I think it would be really interesting to... this sounds kind of cold, but, like, later when there's material, it would be very fascinating to understand how they, you know, because they have internal documents on, like, for example, just the torture and brainwashing process. And maybe they use euphemisms in those documents to refer to torture. But it's not like an ad hoc thing that they have been doing. Like, this is a very deliberate and systematic process. And, for example, in the anti-Falun Gong campaign, I don't know if I mentioned it in that piece I did for China Change, but officials were given awards for, you know, the most successful transformation scores. And they taught, you know, they had training sessions for other labor camps and brainwashing centers.
By transformation scores, that means the number the of quotas, people yeah. that they managed to turn.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And to so, say, I'll no longer practice Falun Gong, I love the party.
Yeah, well, effectively. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there were also, like, you know, academics who... I mean, there were departments in universities for studying this issue, like anti-cult departments, and then they would produce materials.
Anti-cult, because that's what they labeled Falun Gong as.
Yes.
Sort of how they now label Uyghur Muslims as terrorists.
Right, and I'm sure you could see... in fact, it would be fascinating to know whether some of the same people who were doing the anti-cult workbooks that were used in labor camps have now kind of moved on to the next thing, and they're doing the anti-extremification. Yeah.
What so, a life's work.
But the point is simply to say that this is, I mean, it's something taken very seriously. Like, huge amounts of intellectual resources and material resources are poured into this issue of how you, like, break people down. You know, control their environment. You have the facilities for doing so. They had the theoretical underpinning with these academics. They had the security guys, you know, promulgating the best practices. It's...
That's horrifying.
So horrifying, I guess we have to laugh.
It's very interesting to study. So the reason I know so much about this stuff, my PhD is on... the development of organ transplantation in China. And
at first that doesn't seem related at all.
It is widely, I mean, there is a great deal of evidence that would suggest that Falun Gong has been a major target of organ harvesting. And so, you know, as part of that research, then I have, you know, and for some time, read a great deal about the anti-Falun Gong campaign.
And supposedly they're also... harvesting the organs of Uyghurs as well, to a lesser degree, but the statistics are probably a bit hard to gather.
It is very difficult to know. It stands to reason. As part of my field work, I want to try to investigate that question to the extent that it can be on the ground among exiles. However, like, the reason that this is thought to have happened to Falun Gong, or at least... one of the pieces of evidence is witnesses outside of China now who testify to have not only being blood tested, which is to some degree par for the course in labor camps when everyone is admitted, but subject to very odd examinations of their organs, abdominal organs, heart, lungs, including with ultrasounds, x-rays, and in a way that's outside of the standard labor camp health inspection process, so that it will be a bus that comes from outside. And then only the Falun Gong people are marched in, and you know, no one says anything, and they take several vials of blood, and they're given these extensive examinations. And those, you know, not for general health. And those examinations would be necessary. So if you were to use their organs or identify them as potential forced donors, you would have to do that. And they're difficult to explain in another way. And so, you know, that with many other things is part of the reason that it is thought that they may have been used as an organ source. Yes. So that same evidence does not yet exist for Uyghurs, as in like a lot of people outside China. But that could change with, you know, people just slipping through the cracks and then coming out and testifying to that. And if we see that, then, you know, these things are very difficult to prove. So that's part of the, you know, why I'm doing the PhD, is to kind of understand from a social science perspective what counts as proof, so to speak.
That's certainly some of the most ghoulish things I've heard in a while. And I just watched Netflix's new Sabrina show, which is all about Satanism. Okay, so...
I admire your attempt to lighten up the topic by talking about Satanism.
Sabrina
with
the cat?
Yeah, yes. They made a new one.
There's a new one that's darker.
Yeah, there's all kinds of Hail Satan.
Everything's getting darker.
I'm just disappointed that the cat doesn't talk in the new one.
The cat in the new one is like this weird, scary demon monster.
No,
thing.
That was the best part, the snarky cat puppet.
Yeah, he's not snarky. Sabrina's kind of snarky. Hey, anyways, we're doing a podcast. So
we needed to lighten it up with Satanism.
We did. All right, organ harvesting, let's lighten it up, Satanism. So definitely what I'm gathering from you is, like, this has been happening. The idea of the Communist Party singling out a group and persecuting them, they've been doing this for a long, long time. But I've noticed there seems to be almost a sense of surprise about the persecution of the Uyghurs. This idea that, oh, China's getting worse, which it seems to me like, just look at Falun Gong. It's not getting worse. It's always been this bad. But it seems like there's sort of a disconnect where, like, people have kind of forgotten what happened to Falun Gong.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
So why do you think that is? What's going on there?
Although I think the timing, I mean, I think there are at least two ideas or ways of addressing it. One is simply, you know, the place, and I mentioned this in the piece very briefly, but the place that Falun Gong occupies in Western consciousness versus Uyghurs, to the extent that it occupies any place, but is different, and that, I think, has determined the reactions. But just stepping back from that, the timing is, I think, also quite important. So, like, 1999, there weren't as many... I mean, China was not as connected to the world as it was. Communications technologies were not as advanced. So, like, let's say if Falun Gong was taught in China, like, in the year 2000, and then now, and, like, you know, by now you've got, like, 70 million people or whatever, and then now it's persecuted, I imagine that the reaction would be kind of similar. And at the time, also, the anti-Falun Gong campaign was, like, very widely covered in the media. The issue is that, like, after, like, a few years... just dropped off because, like, hey, it's nothing to see. Like, it's, you know, this is, you know, we're right, it's still going on.
Same old.
Right.
Same old,
so
torturing
we can,
people. Yeah.
We can look forward to the Uyghur story dropping off when newspapers and
its
TV shows stop getting the views from it.
Well, like, if you imagine the ideal scenario for the CCP, I mean, obviously they're trying to, like, get rid of this population, like, by even, like, breeding them out.
Right.
And, like, transforming them. And so, like, in 10 years, like, so they don't want the Uyghur to exist. And you could imagine a scenario in which, like, they have succeeded. Well, it appears that, I mean, can you see, like, unless there's some big political change in China and the campaign stops, if everything continues on current trajectories, I mean, I don't see why they will not be successful. And then in 20 years...
Despite the public outcry that's currently going on.
Yeah, well, like, I mean, the public outcry obviously doesn't determine what Tung Chung Guo is doing.
No.
Up there.
They can, they feel like maybe they can just, like, have some, like, CCTV come in and do a video about how it's just, you know, we're teaching them how to work in factories.
Right.
And,
making
also,
sure they don't become terrorists.
And they also, you know, they get to make their bread, so we're not eliminating their culture. Yeah.
They still get to make the bread?
Yeah, there was one that CCTV had, like, it was like a 60 Minutes style thing where they're, like, going inside one of these, you know, re-education camps and all the happy workers learning to, you know, sew pants and stuff like that. And also they're making electric ovens to make their naan bread. So it's like they're upgrading Uyghur
technology. Nice one.
New Uyghur culture, right? Yeah.
It just reminded me.
Tibet. Oh, go ahead.
When there were reporters that were brought to tour, I believe it was Masanjar, like one of the most brutal labor camps. It might have been another one. Doesn't particularly matter which one it was, but that was torturing Falun Gong. And they... the guards had like set up everything really nice. They had like bunnies and deers.
Wait, like
and deer, like
deer.
Yeah, wait, like animals.
Yeah, like cuddly, fluffy animals, like in the courtyard, like hopping around, nibbling on the grass and stuff.
It's not a labor camp; it's a petting zoo.
I had.
Wow, this is an old report about that. So it's like it's kind of.
Torture on Monday, finger painting on Tuesday.
It's pet therapy. It's
well, yeah, because they
therapy.
Were well, because they were being deprogrammed from the sinister cult, right? And so you know, the animals would have helped. You can imagine how people they would have workshopped that.
Did that work with the reporters?
I think they noted it in a kind of ironic way. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly they wouldn't be that stupid. Like, oh, this is
yeah. I mean, after the history of the Soviet Union, I think we know that like anytime. Like foreign reporters get a tour of a labor camp, or a detention center. It's probably not exactly what you're seeing.
Right, that is, I think, it's a wonderful touch.
It is. Oh my gosh, where do we go from petting zoo, labor camp? Shelley, I need you to feel this one. I'm just lost.
Well, I thought it was interesting what you were talking about. Like the part of the reason is kind of the way that the internet works now, right? That people know about this stuff. More widely,
even China.
Yeah. Well, I don't actually know.
Well, they have internet in China.
Yes.
More now.
But people are doing things like using Google Earth to find these labor camp or re-education camps.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Things like that wouldn't have been done. But
right.
Which actually makes me kind of scared about what Google satellites are doing outside of. China. Anyways, carry on.
Okay,
China.
That's...
not Google's.
Are they spying on me, Shelley? I mean, I wouldn't blame them.
Mm-hmm.
I live an exciting life.
No, okay.
You had a point, I'm sorry. You're taking a long time to get to it.
So my question is kind of... You said, let's say the regime doesn't change in the next 10 years. You think that, like, there's no reason the campaign wouldn't be successful. Has there ever been a campaign that... the Communist Party stopped for, like, other reasons than its successful conclusion?
I don't know. I mean, usually, I mean, in past campaigns, they achieve their targets and then they no longer become relevant and there's some new political objective. And so things just move on. And so, like, yeah, the classes that they targeted in the 50s,
there are no longer any counter-revolutionaries.
No, there are no more rightists.
Yeah.
Well, there are, actually, but...
Well, for Falun Gong, you said, like, that Xi Jinping doesn't seem to be emphasizing it, but it's still, like, the mechanism of the system is still... It's still going on.
So with Falun Gong, it has not succeeded. Or it has.
Well, no. Obviously, I mean, the goal was to, you know, eliminate it within 3 months. I believe that was the idea. I haven't seen that in official documents.
Over-promising, under-delivering.
And so, yeah, in a sense, that's been a spectacular failure. But it's not like they can just say, "Oh, hey, about that campaign. well, we kind of messed up on that, and we're just going to rescind it." So, no harm, no foul. You guys can go back to practicing.
Go home. We're cool.
And so, yeah, apart from the practical obstacles, but there's also the No, the Communist Party can't be wrong, obviously. I mean, you guys have been doing this podcast for long enough to know that. And so from that perspective also, you can't just, like, take your bat and ball and go home. And, yeah, so the campaign has failed, but, I mean, it's still in the books.
When riding a tiger, it is difficult to get off. It's a yes. Chinese saying.
But the Falun Gong campaign is more difficult to win than, like, if you have a distinct ethnic population in one area. Mm. And you can, like, then you can actually, like, I mean, they will, I mean, I don't want this to sound the wrong way, but unless something changes, it appears that they will achieve the goals, which appear to be to eliminate that group as a group identity.
Yeah, a cultural identity. So yes.
Not just cultural identity, they are breeding them out of existence.
Well, they can't breed all of them out at once. So, but the idea is, like, younger Uyghurs will stop identifying as Uyghurs and identify as Chinese.
Yeah, right? Identicide is a good term.
Did you come up with that?
No, Steve Levine, a historian.
Identicide?
Yeah, such a good... Because I was... I visited him in North Carolina. He's a retired history professor. And we were just talking about these campaigns and, like, what is it that the CCP is doing when it targets a population and then, like, eliminates them, but that population is not... cannot necessarily be defined by purely, like, racial, you know, or in the case of Falun Gong, it's, like, not a race, it's a practice.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, anyway, identified perfectly summarizes what the...
That's the destruction of their identity.
Yeah.
In a way, they're doing that in Hong Kong, even.
Yeah. Yeah, big time. Wow. And so I think this is a useful... You guys should popularize it.
Oh, wow. We will.
You heard
it
here first on China Unscripted. Identicide. Use it at parties. Impress your friends.
People would be impressed, I think.
Yeah.
We were impressed when you said it. Both of us were like,
a nice new word.
Yeah.
I like the feel of it in my mouth.
Identicide. Yeah.
We should get him on the podcast. What was his name?
Steve Levine.
Steve Levine.
He's a really interesting guy.
Hmm.
So is there any... I guess, is there any hope for the groups being identicided?
Well, I mean, you don't want to say no, right?
I'm hoping you're not going to say no.
But that almost makes it sound like it maybe is no.
Yeah. Yeah, I should go back to watching Sabrina. It's much more uplifting than this.
I just research things. Or I just try to research things.
You just help us understand why the world is a terrible place, not how we can fix it.
Well, look, if... So what if... I'm just trying to think of a scenario in which the Uyghurs could, like, not be eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
So what if everyone kept being a Uyghur?
Mm-hmm.
And they continued their, you know, teaching... Well, it's very difficult under the current circumstances. So hopefully, like, the political impetus will kind of peter out a bit in a few years. And there will be... Like, they won't have shipped out, like, a sufficiently huge number of the population to the rest of China. Because that's, like, the latest thing. And when I first saw the reports about that, I was like, nah. Because they've built so many camps. Like, why are they just shipping people out? But it seems, at least in part, you know, those are one-way trains.
So Uyghurs are being sent to other
parts like, distributed of China. Around the prison system in the rest of China. And this is, like, why kind of my ears pricked up in terms of the organ transplantation angle. Because,
Putting minorities or special groups onto trains, long train rides, that doesn't have a good history.
Right, and so if you, like, so I'm just, like, wildly speculating, okay? This is not in any way kind of any kind of legitimate scientific hypothesis testing.
But it's educated speculation.
If you wanted to use Uyghurs as an organ source for hospitals around China, you have to get them there.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so...
Because the best organ transplant centers are not way out in Xinjiang.
Well, you mean you can't, like... I mean...
Why take the organ somewhere?
You can't. Just completely impractical, right? You can't...
A kidney, it's like 6 hours? A 6-hour window?
I think it's 12, the cold ischemic time, like the time after it's removed from the body. Something. It's 12 to 24. It's longer than livers.
Okay.
But in any case, like, that's completely impractical.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to each hospital, right? So, you know, you did, so the way it worked, the hospitals had a direct relationship with prisons and potentially labor camps. And that's where they got organs, like, for the longest time.
Also, it's a good way to disappear people in terms of if you can see the labor camps in Xinjiang and you can, like if they're spread out around the country, it's harder to keep track of how many Uyghurs are being incarcerated, right?
Yeah, I should think so.
Yeah. So actually, that's one thing that I thought of when it was like Xinjiang has become really visible in the last couple of years, partially because like it's a concentrated place. You can see the security apparatus. Like reporters can literally go to Xinjiang still and like see everything that's happening there. I mean, you probably will get kicked out of China after, but you know, it's visible in a way that it's harder for the Falun Gong thing to be visible because it's spread out and largely underground.
Oh, yeah, any underground group in China, you can't pinpoint it the same way that you can Xinjiang Uyghurs.
So you're saying the Uyghurs could possibly survive if they kind of went underground?
Well, that they are identifiable
by
physical features. So that...
Whoa. What do you mean by physical features?
They're not Han Chinese. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. So what is this going to take? Is there going to need to be external pressure, or is it going to need to require a change within China, within the Communist Party?
To stop the campaign?
To stop all the sadness. I don't know why you're laughing.
I think it's a laugh cry is what's happening here.
There's a lot of that with the show.
Oh God, okay.
Laugh cry.
I don't know. It's like that's the high school newspaper question.
High school newspapers are great in many ways. I mean, you know, I'm not saying I ever wrote for one and it was the best days of my life, but it's a good question. How can we make the world a better place? No, seriously.
World peace.
Is there anything the international community can do to apply pressure on the Chinese Communist Party, or is that futile and the only way anything will change in China is if it comes from within? That's a college paper question. Thank you.
It's an answer. I mean, that's something that hasn't been... We don't know, because there hasn't been that. But, like, if you imagine what it would take to potentially create enough pressure, it would be, like, drastically different international arrangements than we have at present. And so the question as to, like, whether that should be attempted and what effect it would have, I mean, it's, like, not even... I mean, it's just, like, what do you reckon? Like, is this... You know what I mean? Like, there's so many interests and, like, I mean, it relates to the entire, like, configuration of global trade to a certain degree. Because if you, like, were to, let's say you just do to North Korea, do that to China.
Mm.
It's like, okay, like, we don't know how to, like, stop them completely eliminating this population. And we think that that is, you know, the number one priority. And we're going to, like, you know, pull out all the stops to try to stop it, whatever it takes. Well, then everything's on the table, right? Like, if you, like, I don't know, we're just spitballing here.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, well, that's, like, so that's very extreme, like, where it could get to.
And I can see what you mean by,
that's not going to happen,
like,
right?
Yeah, the idea of, like, treating China like North Korea, like, and blocking it off, that's just, like, even saying that sounds insane.
Yeah, it's crazy, yeah. And so, yeah, so... Like, then short of that, you have all kinds of other measures, right? Like, you can use Magnitsky Act to target certain individuals. I think Chen Chengguo has been, I mean, I'm sure someone has prepared a complaint against him. And will that, like, you don't know what impact that will have. It doesn't seem like, I mean, I'm sure the CCP could find a face-saving way, like, technically, like, to stop the campaign. But the question is, like, how much pressure would have to be applied and what kind of pressure in order to put that at the top of, like, Xi Jinping's list and then cause all the, you know, because, like, the CCP is kind of this fascinating, wild, interesting beast because
it, like a deer in a labor camp.
It can do certain extremely difficult, complex tasks at a national scale to a high degree of success, like the anti-Falun Gong campaign, for example, or like the campaign against Uyghurs. But like for other stuff, like I don't know, environmental protection or like safe vaccines, these kind of things, like the same effort isn't put into them, obviously. Mm-hmm. And because like the CCP operates in this kind of campaign mentality or campaign mode, it's able to achieve those policy objectives. It's just that they're like the wrong things. And anyway, like why would you run a country on that basis? But I just mean that obviously they could stop it because they just like stop like locking people up. But then I don't think people are kind of thinking through what you would actually have to do. I mean, I think you could technically, right, like put enough pressure, because technically, like let's say the US said like we're going to try to topple the CCP unless you stop this, and then they actually started doing stuff to do that, I wonder like how you would even go about constructing a policy like that. But I suspect you could. I think it would be technically possible, but I think the cost for would be so high, and it would be such a radical proposition that it's not going to happen. But it's an interesting thought experiment, right?
Mm-hmm. Brought about by my great question.
Yeah, I guess, like, how do you stop them? Regime change.
Uh-huh. But you could take us, like, you wouldn't have to, because I think that, like, I mean, I don't know how these conversations would go with Xi Jinping. But if, like, let's say that he thought that, we have to stop this because it's going to be crazy otherwise, then they would be able to figure out a way to stop it. Like, they could come up with something. Think of something they could come up with. What would they say?
What she?
Yeah, like you got to come up with an excuse to stop the campaign.
Oh, I would imagine like what Xi Jinping could do is like blame everything on like a rival faction.
Boom. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Just purge the guy in Xinjiang.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Xinjiang was tied to the Jiang Zemin faction, and Jiang Zemin was Xi Jinping's main political opponent. So that's not so far fetched. Why are you looking at me like that, both of you? Is it the wisdom?
Too much wisdom.
Too much wisdom. Mm-hmm. That could be a good place to end it. So, thank you for joining us today, Matt.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, great. And if somebody wanted to learn more about you or your work, where can they go? What can they do?
I don't know. I mean, I'm on the Twitters.
Twitters. What's your Twitter handle?
MP Robertson. But I don't really post much. My pinned tweet is like, why you just stop talking when you get older?
So you're like a scholar in the Pusong Ling kind of tradition.
I don't know.
Watch out for foxes. Well, thank
that
you.
That is so obscure.
That was just for you. Seriously. That was just for you.
If you understood that reference, please leave a comment and let us know.
All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of China Unscripted. Remember, check us out on iTunes or ChinaUnscripted.com. Once again, I'm Chris.
I'm Shelley.
And talk to you next time.